Good morning. Good morning and welcome. Hi, how are you? As people take their seats, we just have a very short housekeeping announcement to make, which is there are a few social entrepreneurs in the room who are scheduled to go to a global meeting in Vienna later today or tomorrow. That will be postponed, and the Ashoka Fellows scheduled to go to Vienna will meet at 4 o'clock this afternoon in the dining hall of Exeter College. So 4 o'clock this afternoon in the dining hall of Exeter College. And with that, we'll start the session. Diana.
I have one other housekeeping announcement, which was I've been asked to ask you to turn off your cell phones or mobile phones. And during the Q&A session, we'll be passing around microphones. The session's going to be recorded, so we've been asked to make sure that you have you are speaking into a microphone when you're contributing. So my name is Diana Wells. I'm president of Ashoka. When Skoll asked me to lead a session on collaborative leadership, the initial question that they posed was social entrepreneurship is a very tall order and a tall, tough job description, and would you talk about that? Well, anybody who knows me knows that I'm a person of few words, and so I suggested that we workshop it instead, because I certainly don't have all the answers, and many of you in the room would. So here we are. I will give a brief introduction. We're going to then move into a brainstorming mode and some table work. We'll bring the table work back to the full group and present and do some Q&A around some of the solutions. So in itself, this session should be an act of collaborative leadership. That's the goal. At Ashoka, we have learned that social entrepreneurs change systems primarily through the power of their ideas. They build organizations as vehicles to advance these ideas, and they recognize that to achieve large-scale change, to advance their ideas, that success rests on the ability to spread and advance the ideas through complex networks, complex and diverse networks. For this workshop, the goal is to explore the ways we've learned how to do this. We, not being Ashoka, but everybody in the room, to share some of what I've known and what I've wrestled with as while we're building a new kind of organization, which the idea being that social entrepreneurs are building a new type of organization. They're drawing from business. Because I'm in the UK, I'll say we're also drawing from the charity sector. But Bill Drayton uses the term citizen sector as an emblem of the new kind of organization we are building. It's an organization that's more participatory. There's not one idea. There are multiple ideas. There are multiple players. And this is emblematic of the world that we're moving to, where there are, and that we're all witnessing happening, where there are more participants making decisions, and participating and having a voice. And we think this is a good thing, because when you look through a historical scope, we see that the societies who have progressed or societies who are excelling are the societies where more people have had a voice. Bill Drayton's genius in starting Ashoka was to recognize that in order to... In order to understand where the world is going, one way to do that is to tap early stage innovation. And that early stage innovation can be a predictive factor of where the world is going. My hope is that this workshop provides a collaborative space where we can discuss some of our leadership challenges and solutions and begin to build that predictive space for a new kind of organization which we're seeing emerge and which is very actively emerging. When I started my work at Ashoka, it was in 1988. There were 100 fellows, social entrepreneurs in 4 countries. Nobody really knew the term social entrepreneur yet. In my capacity, as a first an unpaid intern and a recent college grad, I started to build the next the first work that Ashoka did to support, not in non-financial ways, the work of social entrepreneurs. I built a network of volunteers who provided one-on-one support for fellows. I stepped out of my role at Ashoka for a decade, pursued a PhD in social movements and anthropology, and came back to Ashoka in 1998. I have grown up with Ashoka, and Ashoka's grown up with me. Over the last 5 years, as I have led Ashoka through a dramatic increase in growth, it's required a series of both infrastructure changes and organizational design changes, as well as rolling out and supporting the entrepreneurs in-house who are developing a new series of Ashoka programs. 3 years in, the global economic crisis hit, and I had an unexpected task on my plate. I have no doubt that there will be a book written in the not-too-distant future about what leaders have done and what they did to get through this period. I was shocked by how my role shifted to managing panic over a very long, extended period of time. And it was panic not so much of people internally, but externally, partners, wondering how they were going to survive, whether Ashoka was going to come through this, and how Ashoka was going to survive the economic downturn. And in responding, I found myself saying things that were true, that were, of course we were going to survive, we've been doing this long enough, but also, this is a new opportunity for us to have a deeper impact. And in fact, we not only elected the same number of fellows, but we started two brand new programs last year that were deepening the kind of impact that we already had, building off of the base that we had built. I was reminded that social entrepreneurs see opportunities where others see adversity. And this hit home no better than when one day I was talking to one of our social entrepreneurs who said, "I don't know why everybody thinks the world is going to end. When was the last time you thought you knew that your budget was going to close in that year?" This is the reality that so many of us in the sector live with each year, that uncertainty, the ambiguity, and are comfortable in that ambiguity, because when you are leading something that is going to create profound change, the answer is clear in your head, but it's very ambiguous for everybody else. And moving through that ambiguity to pursue that clear vision is a challenge. It takes conviction, it takes persistence. You all know this, I'm sure, because you do it every day. In this new environment, there's no question that many of the old ideas have failed, and social entrepreneurs have something significant to say to the world. Ashoka's experienced that uptake. I'm sure many of you have, too, in this recent period. I often say that the privilege of my role is that I get to see the world through a lens of solutions. And what a gift that is. All of us who are part of this movement share that ability. For the session, as we break into groups, my hope is we can, in a collaborative way, share our experiences, our ideas about building institutions for collaborative leadership. I'll turn this over to my colleague, Felix Oldenburg, who is the director of our Ashoka Germany, who will be our facilitator for the session. But we'll also ask for those of you at tables, one of you to be help. But Felix is going to work us through the logistics.
Thanks, Diana. I'll do this standing up. Can everybody hear me okay? It's fine. Well, it's wonderful to have so many of you here. Let's start right away with making this interactive. Thank you, Diana, for the initial observations. Some painful, some were very forward-looking about
our experiences over the last 2 years as a global organization and platform. And let's kick this off, this exploration over the next more than an hour of what sort of organizations we need to build in order to increase our impact even in difficult times, to deliver on the promise of helping to change the world. And I'd like to kick this off with a brainstorming with all of you. Think back over the last 2 years, just as Diana has done now, which organization, your own or that of a partner, has impressed you with increasing its social impact? And how have they done it? We have a few entrepreneurs in this room who I happen to know better than others. Torquil, Andreas, Bart, others. What comes to mind for you as you think back over the last 2 years, your own organization or partner organizations? So give us a few words of your observations. How have organizations kept the level of impact, even raised their game, despite of the very, very difficult circumstances that we all had to face? No, you won't.
Thank you. My name is Torquil Sonne. I've specialized in assessing, training, and employing people with autism. I have 40 people with autism now. It's because my younger son was diagnosed with autism 10 years ago. I found out that the labor market rejects everyone who do not fit with the requirements on being flexible, being good team players, being good at handling stress, and so on. And I thought that was so unfair. I started up with the view of parents for our son, but I found out after being chairman of local branch of the autism organization for 3 years that there are so many. I arranged a meeting, invited people in my small hometown. Parents who have children with autism, please come and meet me. There were 25, I didn't think. I thought I would have gone to the wrong room, but there are so many, but they are so isolated all over the place today. What has really been amazing to me is how much impact a positive story, will have all over the world. There are so many people there sitting in isolation with the same need to be respected and accepted as equal parts in society. It's scaring. The dimension is scaring. There's perhaps 1% of the population that has the autistic trait. There may be 2 to 5% of the population with ADHD trait. So I think what the impact we've done so far, being BBC World, ABC News, and so on, is setting the example, giving hopes to so many parents out there who write me and ask me to start up in their country. The scaring part is we set expectations all over the place. How do we fulfill our promise to all the families out there? We could be the biggest force on this globe if we do it in a knowledge share and collaborative way, if we use the energy out there.
Thank you. So I heard two things from that, Torquil. One is you mentioned the parents and how you very early involved them. So that's connecting stakeholders. And then deal with expectations, what you just said. You know, even in a difficult environment, you can't really say, no, I've announced that I'm going to change the world in this way, but it's really becoming hard. So give me time, I'll do it later. So those are two things.
And maybe the storytelling.
And the storytelling, yeah. That's a good one too.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Who else wants to go and maybe also talk about the experience in the last 2 years of increasing impact in a very difficult environment? What have you done as an organization, or what has a partner done to achieve that? Introduce yourself.
So, hi, I'm Michael Chertok, and I work for Digital Divide Data. And we work in Cambodia and Laos with a model to work with very poor young people to recruit them into a social enterprise where they deliver IT services. And they go through IT skills training and English skills training. And then they do a work-study program where they go to school and also at the same time are employed. And at the end of 4 years, they become leaders where they can go out and have much better jobs working with international NGOs, government, and the private sector. And we've developed a sustainable business model, but over the last 2 years, we've seen another newer organization, who some of you may have heard from in the last session, Samasource, that has had a very similar idea about this, but has gone out with an advocacy model to start to show the world that this can not only happen in one place with one organization, but this can start to become a global model equivalent to the fair trade model. And we're starting to look at how we can work together with Samasource to work with allies and partners who are doing this kind of work all over the world and start to create a movement around it. And so we're really excited about the opportunities going forward.
Okay, so if they're bigger plans around collaborate to create a movement.
Collaboration and the power of advocacy.
And is it collaborating to extend networks or to are you extending the network to?
I think our vision is now how can we create networks of organizations who are joined together in a movement, and how do we create a solidarity around mm-hmm. work together?
Great.
The solidarity thing as well. Great. Other examples. We've got quite a few now. So the more participation, the briefer we have to be. So in order to let everybody participate in this first round, introduce yourself in very brief observations.
I'll be very brief. Hello, my name's Dee Kine. I work in health, in primary healthcare, and we run a social business in the UK, putting the patient at the centre, redesigning the way that people receive their healthcare. We're also working in India. One of the things I have found over the last 2 years is that our relationship with the public sector has become a stronger one, and that where we were the people knocking at the door from the outside, we're now the people who are creating the solutions to the point where our local strategic health authority now says, sugar, you guys are the only people with the solution. You're the only game in town, so we're going to put a lot of money into you because we haven't put any investment into growing ideas. And there's a lot of that happening with us a little in India where people are saying, the government can't afford this. So, briefly. I think the organizational insight for us would be that we've been working in the wilderness, irregardless, making change, and what we're realizing is we are now in a very strong position to negotiate that change.
It sounds like the outside has become the insider in the way that people were talking about in the session on neural networks. Yes. And I could follow with something from one of our partners. We support a project in the DRC in the Congo. They started as quite a small organization, but because we've been able to fund them to travel, they've now got a reputation as mediators right across Nord Kivu, which is quite a conflict-affected area. And recently they were asked by the UN to mediate in a conflict between local people who are very angry with the international NGOs and the international NGOs. So what I've sort of seen is that by applying resources in terms of money for travel and subsistence, they've been able to demonstrate credibility that has got them into the charmed circle of insiders.
Mm-hmm. So providing resources for more people to participate.
Say again?
Providing resources strategically so that key stakeholders can participate, or not even stakeholders, new.
If you were to explain this to another organization, what would you say they would need to do?
I would say there's huge latent capacity among local organizations, but the lack of resources means that capacity stays latent. Therefore, if we apply resources to this latent capacity, eventually the people with the power and resources, like the UN, will realize, a bit like what you were saying, that actually the answers lie outside, and they're not going to succeed unless they bring the outsiders into their charmed circle.
So they use resources to activate
Yes.
I'm Vicky Colbert. I'm from Colombia. I direct Escuela Nueva. It's a Colombian NGO. I'm an Ashoka and SCO fellow. And we have a powerful model of collaborative learning, and we have developed the tools. I think one of the main reasons is we've had solid research evidence behind. So I've never done fundraising. We're self-financed. But because we have solid research basis behind showing how the impact of Escuela Nueva not only on learning achievement but on peaceful behavior, then governments come to us and private sector come to us. So let's say I've spread out in Latin America, reaching more than 5 million children in 14 countries, mainly through governments. And that is good for coverage, but not good for quality and sustainability. So my message is you need to have public-private partnerships. So in our case, since the crisis never affected us because we've never done fundraising, so the interesting thing is the Petroleum Company of Colombia came to us. So they helped us reach the most remote areas because they know we have a powerful model. There's bases behind, research behind. And also, they know it's a public policy because this has become a public policy in many countries, which is good, but it's not sufficient. So it's public and private. The two messages are evidence, research behind to be strong so people can come to you. So now the government of Vietnam came last year, vice minister, many other countries are coming. But then I'm always looking for the private sector in each country to have this public-private relationship.
All right, I'm doing now. I will be focused. Yeah, so I'm doing now 22 years, Dialogue in the Dark, and in the last 2 years, I think we ramped up with expansion to US, to India, and to Asia foremost. And what I learned in the last 2 years is definitely we shifted from, let's say, business as unusual to business as usual. And we were accompanied by Bain, and they gave us a wonderful, let's say, consultation over quite a while that we learned much better processing and then to understanding, to target more clearer, to have a better budget planning. So this is really business as unusual. This was one. Secondly, what I understood to ramp up is that I, as a founder, had to step back. That means I shrinked a little bit. So I understood if the company would really, and the idea and the mission has to grow, I, as a founder, I'm a bottleneck. And so I really now shrinking, become more and more small, and I'm sure in 2 years nobody will recognize me. But this is perfectly okay, because in a certain moment you become, let's say, a barrier for ramp up. And the third element is definitely, I think, and this is why what I learned, I think we are all the time confronted with a lot of crisis, and life is unpredictable, and it's perfectly okay. That means, I think, what we learned, I think, from being a social entrepreneur, we all the time coping with these sort of, let's say, really stress factors and crisis. And there was a wonderful saying by a guy, Gordimer. He wrote a book about multiple intelligence. And he said that the future leaders, and if there would be, say, an Oscar award, not Oscar, a Nobel Prize, maybe Oscar either, then I think it should be social entrepreneurs, because they definitely have, let's say, the blend of a social mission, of a, let's say, social responsibility, and of course, I think with a lot of, let's say, business skills in the future.
I'm told I need to speak into the microphone. We've got a second one here. So I've got you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, all right? We'll get through this, and we'll have, let's be brief. Okay, hi.
I actually think that this crisis has been an incredible opportunity. My name is Natalie Miller. I'm a school associate here at SBS, but I'm with an organization called Operation Smile. And I do the development in Africa. And we use the economic crisis as an incredible opportunity to diversify revenue streams and to bring on new donors and to create more local ownership. So DRC, we work in the Congo as well, and we actually got 100% of the program's provided by local companies, like sponsored by local companies. So telling them that, like, we do not have the funds to support things from outside, and if we want to make this happen in DRC, then the Congolese have to step up as corporates and each take a part in it. So each company provided a certain amount of funds, and we are able to bring in a huge number of donors that have now all become partners and bringing it forward.
Thank you. My takeaway from that is also the importance of local ownership. Let's hear a few more. And what I realize that a lot of you are speaking about the external relations. And Andreas has just raised the important point about the, you know, how the founder becomes a bottleneck, and maybe some things need to change within the organization too. So maybe we can focus on that a little bit. What changes within your organization to be able to change the world? Can we sort of give that over?
I'm Parker Mitchell, co-founder of Engineers Without Borders Canada. We had the same situation as everyone. What we decided to do, we realized we had a technology-based mission that was no longer relevant. So in January of last year, we stood up at our AGM and had everyone burn the mission statement. We did not have a replacement for it, and it was to push innovation out to the edges of the network.
Mike, hold the mic.
Sorry, and we wanted to keep the same growth aspirations from the point of view of impact, but we had much less money, so we said, what's our untapped resources? It's people. So we created sort of EWB 2.0, we called it, which was pushing more of the innovation to the edges of the network. It was a big change for me personally, because we'd started to centralize more and more as we had more issues with quality. We wanted to make sure we reached certain quality levels, and so that we tended to centralize, so we had to consciously step back from that and trust people to drive the full project at the edges of the organization. So that was a big personal challenge.
No, very succinct. Push innovation to the edge of the organization. I think we'll wrestle with that for a little bit. All right. Let's get this through here.
My name is Jack Sim, founder of the World Toilet Organization. We're going to meet. I see that a lot of us has not so much resources, but the others have resources. So internally, what the World Toilet Organization or WTO does is it leverage on other people's resources. So I have a partnership with Andreas, and we set up a Dialogue in the Dark in Singapore. I just discussed with a partnership with Esquela Novo, yeah? And I think we can go to all her school with toilets. And Parker is also asking for a meeting. So I think internally, we all have plenty of resources. But if we were to work alone, we're so small, you know. But if we hitch a ride, maybe we can call this a piggyback system. If we piggyback on each other, actually, it's fantastic. We won't have enough of lifetime to work with as many that is relevant.
All right, so invite partner resources. Very key point. Let's pass on the microphone. And it'll get to you in just a second.
My name's Christopher Pelley, and I'm in from Denver, Colorado. And I'm a business person. I'm not a social activist. But for over 3 years, we've promoted the idea of social entrepreneurship, especially with Ashoka in the Denver, Colorado region, attempting to find that holy grail, the link into the private wealth and the business community, the M&A. So we're trying to find the source of funds for all of you, and great success because Ashoka came up with great ideas. We have 7 universities in the Rocky Mountain region who are excited. Colorado University of Colorado is doing the Change Your Campus program. We learned about the Change Your City program in Dublin, and we're proud to say that Denver, the mayor and the governor, are all behind Change Your City Denver that'll be tied into the biennial in the next month, where we'll have people from 35 countries in the Western Hemisphere. So we're trying to raise awareness and collaboration amongst academics, the business community through M&A private equity groups that I've been affiliated with for many years, and then the citizen sector, both the nonprofits as well as the government. And we're having great success on raising awareness, and all of it's tied in even back over here to Engineers Without Borders. Bernard Omdier at the University of Colorado was just named a Ashoka Fellow. So all of those pieces now are raising more awareness, and more business people are wondering, how can they get involved with money as well as their business acumen to help make a difference? So we're really pleased with that impact in our Rocky Mountain region. We thank Ashoka for that.
Well, what I take away from that is sort of incubate locally and then spread to another place, maybe. And so this is an aspect that we haven't heard so far. You took the idea of the Changemaker campus, brought it to the place that you cared about. You heard of the Change Your City initiative in Dublin, brought it, yes. You know, didn't reinvent the wheel locally. All right, let's pass this on.
Well, ultimately, I've been here for 6 years, and one of the issues was the academic community loves this, the social activists love this, but if you don't find the business people who have the for-profit people, if they don't find a way to bridge the gap between what I would label non-profit Greek with for-profit Latin, then that's a transformative issue, because sometimes, as some of you might know, we don't communicate that well. So how do we get more business people with their revenue and their business acumen to be more involved to help get behind your passion and your ideas? And I think we've just about figured it out.
Very important additional point, the business social bridges. Okay.
Hi, my name is Donia Sadet, and we have an Egyptian NGO. It's a family NGO. And we actually had two challenges for the past 5 years and that we have overcome. One of them, maybe it's a bit different than the rest have said, that we had to win credibility from the people to come and let us serve them, because it's always been, when the association name is called El Sadat Association, if you're familiar with the late President Anwar Sadat of Egypt, and this is this family NGO, so with any relations to the government, people don't have credibility. So it took us a lot of effort in order to tell them that we're serving with no return, and someone have mentioned that the outsiders becomes the insiders, and that was our key. And then people started coming and saying that this is it, we want you here forever. And since then, we served people, and we made people from within the community themselves to be our staff.
Okay, so this was a bit inside. Yeah. Yes. So the credibility focus.
Exactly, and credibility
how
and honesty.
Inside, outside. All right, I would like to hear from two or three more. Yeah, we'll have more chances, but maybe on a focus on, again, within your organization. Think about the leadership, think about how the teams work. What have you done within your organization over the last 2 years that has made a real difference? I'll have to say three more, and then we'll have a next round, but we need a quick reflection on what we've come up with so far. All right.
My name is Vera Cordeiro. I run an organization called Saúde Criança, that means health children in Brazil. And we had those last 2 years, we had, you know, I call myself an international beggar because I have to go all the time trying to find money. You know, Brazil is such a divided country, have the rich here and the poor here. It's very hard to go to the rich. And David Bornstein, who wrote How to Change the World, he keeps saying to me, you have to have a trust fund. And I put in my mind, I have to have a trust fund. And finally, we started our trust fund, and the richest man in Brazil, he gave us money, and now we have a trust fund, and that changed a lot the culture of the inside the institution, because the employees, the stakeholders, they have more enthusiasm. They know the institution is more self-sustainable.
Okay, so you used the opportunity to really reinvent the organization, how you did fundraising there.
Yeah, because the most important thing is Brazil, in the first world, everybody understands what is a trust fund endowment. In Brazil, only, I don't know, we and other few organizations has a trust fund.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any comments on the specific issue of leadership and teamwork within the organization? Want to hear from those now. Promise?
Promise.
All right. Bart promises too.
Yeah, three aspects there. For then, in terms of within the organization, I'm Bart Wagens, working with APOPO, Hero Rats, rats trained to save human lives. This crisis creates an enormous stress both on the business as on the social enterprise. So there is we're acting in a bigger stress environment. The stress on business is that they're forced because the ethical issue becomes more stringent. What that means for social enterprise, they're forced to provide better metrics. So they have to become more efficient, mm-hmm. and they have to diversify their teams in order to tackle more complex situations.
Talk about that. How do you diversify teams to tackle more
complex situations? In terms of leadership. For instance, and in case of APOPO, we've been really lucky in the past few years to get several recognitions with several foundations assisting us to go through that growth, which has enabled us to establish a management team which is much more diversified and ready to tackle more complex issues than before.
Thanks. All right. This is a promise. Mike, and two more.
My name is Essen Jamil, and I'm here from the Aman Foundation, which is based out of Pakistan. We started about a year and a half ago, so my experience is pertaining to that. We don't have a funding problem. We had lots of funds, but we had a very ambitious program to follow. We wanted to set up 150 ambulances and serve the city of Karachi within a year and a half. We had to set up a vocational training institute. The pressure was to put down and deliver a number of things. So to get the trust of the trustees, as well as build the team to make actual impact on the ground. And the big learning for me was that the only way to do this is to make sure that the team members' leadership gets utilized. Mm-hmm. And in trying to make this happen, it was also building a culture in which people actually trusted each other and backed each other. And there was a risk, and there was an awareness of how this could go pretty badly wrong. But I think, ultimately, it was a process of, you know, continuously showing that you trusted the other person, you were backing them, stay transparent. And a lot of the people showed their leadership when they were given the space.
Right, what I take away from that is distributed leadership and the culture of trust. Focus on these two. Now, two more. Got here?
Thank you. My name is John Seisloff. I'm a journalist, and I want to talk about Partners in Health for a moment. We've done a lot of stories about social entrepreneurs, and we actually had crews in Haiti covering Partners in Health when the earthquake hit. Crisis is a force multiplier. People in a world that's full of white noise pay attention when bad things happen, and they only pay attention at that moment. And to your point about how it changed the organization, Partners in Health is about building systems that last in villages. They had to transform themselves into a crisis response network, which was out of their comfort zone, mm-hmm. but which enabled them to leverage a tremendous amount of new investment and donor interest.
Excellent. Anne in the back.
Hi, I'm Grace, a current MBA student, school scholar this year. I just want to talk about the type of people who work for social enterprises and how we can leverage those type of people. I think the type of people who are here in this room and who are here in the school forum and people who work for us, they belong to an economy called what I call the meaning-based economy. In the past, there was skill-based and then there was knowledge-based, but I think what we're moving forward towards is what we call a meaning-based economy where we don't just want to make money.
So how about the people then?
Sorry?
You mentioned that's all about the people.
Yeah, and it's all about the people, and I just want to apply something from marketing okay. into managing your employees, which is something called customer insight. I think we have to apply one-to-one type of HR policy, not something, standardized HR policies can only work to a certain extent, but we need to understand what motivates each employee personally, because they work for you for probably even a spiritual reason. You know, it's something very passionate. Don't underestimate that passion, because that is what that drives them. So really get to know what motivates each of them and try to give them that within the organization. Give them a target, but don't control how they reach that target. Let them explore their own motivations and how they get things done. So, yeah, that's it about HR.
Right.
Anne in the back has been waiting for a very long time. Last one.
Thank you, Diana. I'm Anne Enrico from the Philipson Foundation. We are a foundation supporting African organizations in Western Africa and Central Africa. Just want to make one remark. When I've asked one of our partners in Mali if the crisis had an impact on his organization, he looked at me with a big smile and said, but Africa has been in a crisis state for so many years that it doesn't really make a difference. And that just reminds me that it's also a question of perspective. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, as a foundation, we do support a collaboration design through a collaboration amongst three local organizations one from Senegal, the other one from Burkina, and the third one from Mali. Those three organizations have decided to collaborate to generate new ideas, and eventually they have designed a new mechanism which integrates complementary expertise. So for me, collaboration, it's also about new ideas, new mechanism, and integrating experience. The impact it had on the organization was that each organization now has new skills, has learned new competencies and expertise, and the collaboration, another point which is very important, not only happens at the leadership level or at the staff level, but also at what people said, beneficiaries levels. And it has been very powerful to witness the organization traveling from one country to the other country where, with rural women, and enabling connection amongst beneficiaries has been one of the most powerful and wonderful way to generate impact in with very limited means.
All right, I've taken away quite a few from this. The last point, spread through beneficiaries, but also integrate the experience and the new ideas for collaboration. All right, let's step back for a moment, because we have a lot of great ideas here, and in a way we need to integrate the experience. And I want to push it back to you in a moment. Diane, any additional insights? What are your observations on this?
It's very exciting. So much came out. And just overall themes, I'm hearing more participation from more people. I'm hearing a lot of the network piece and the trust and meaning piece, the fuzzy but deep stuff that drives everything, I think, are critical.
I think there are clusters here.
Yeah.
Maybe there's. I think one thing we've heard several times is about the storytelling, the vision, how to become a magnet, deal with the expectations, you know, become an attractive organization that others seek out. You know, that saves a lot of energy and helps you change the world. And then there were a whole lot of points about don't control, motivate, create solidarity, reinvent the organization, push innovation to the edges. So a whole lot of about local ownership, a whole lot about where are the driving forces in the organization? Maybe not so much in the center. So also say this is perhaps sort of drivers, innovators, maybe that's another cluster. And then there's one on collaboration, connect stakeholders, collaborate to create a movement, go out of the wilderness to negotiate change, use resources to activate partner capacity. The inside becomes the outside and the other way around. Invite partner resources. So that's all about collaboration. And using partner resources rather than your own. And that's sort of a very different growth model in a way that kicks in crisis mode. And then we heard a few points about how do you deal with leadership and teams in the organization. The founder may be more critical than ever in a crisis mode, but also maybe more problematic than ever. That was an interesting insight. Then diversify teams and leadership. Incubate local ideas and spread them. Also transfer ideas from one end to your network to the other end. And distributed leadership. So how do we call that? Leadership and teams? What I'd like to do now, I'd like to give it back to you. Who would like, you know, we'll do this table-wise, and we have one group is these three tables over here, right? One group's here, these two tables, and yours too, okay? So these three, and we've got these two plus the participants sitting at the back. Okay, so these two plus you, and we've got these two here. Hi. All right, these two here. Now, get ready. Which of you table groups would like to tackle vision and story? How do you develop vision and story as an organization to improve your impact in times of crisis? Not a winner. Okay. Well, you three get it. All right. Come and get your flip chart. You should drag the flip chart maybe over there so that you can sort of jointly work on it, collaborate. All right. Which group of tables would like to deal with where the drivers, where the forces come from in an organization, where the innovation comes from?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Yes. These two? Fantastic. Go get your flip chart. Collaboration. How to connect with the outside world, invite stakeholder resources. The inside becomes the outside. How do you set your organization up for collaboration? Would you like it or you? All right, it goes over here. Which means you are lucky you get leadership and teams. Okay? Everybody happy? Now, what we do, listen up. What we do, we've got 15 minutes for this. You don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't want me to whistle into this microphone. It's going to be really bad. Okay, what you want to do? Over the next 15 minutes, what are the organizational lessons? What would you teach another organization about how to become the sort of organization that achieves this? How would you teach another organization to do this? What would be sort of the management consulting insights that you have to transform an organization into an organization that manages to achieve what we've just identified an organization can do in times of crisis? So simple insights, and afterwards we'll ask you to every table group to introduce the two or three most important succinct insights, organizational insights, that you would teach another organization. Okay? We've got 15 minutes. All right. Thank you. Can we continue this discussion in the plenary in just a second? Willie, thank you very, very much for helping facilitate. Can we continue this? Can we bring the discussion back into the plenary, please? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Let's continue that in plenary in just a moment, okay? Yes, I'm stopping you. All right, I'm stopping you too. Stop. I'm stopping you too. Stop. And I'm stopping you too. Stop now. All right. Let's start. Let's listen to the wisdom that was generated in this room. And let me just say, please. Well, you have coffee break in a few minutes. So let's bring the vision together that we've generated in this room. And I've noticed that quite a few people have been taking notes on the flip chart, but also personal notes. So what we can do to capture the knowledge is, if you want to hand in the notes to us, we promise we will transcribe them and put them on the Pathable site that is connected to this session so that you can review all the notes. So all the notes that you have been taking that you want to share with us, even if you want to write them down now in a clean way, every note that you give to us, we'll type them up, including the flip charts, okay? So that nothing is lost and we can fully concentrate on the discussion. Let's listen to the great organizational insights of group number one, storytelling and vision, What are the things, maybe you can pick two or three that really stand out for you. What would you advise an organization to do in order to be to use vision and story to increase impact in times of crisis?
Okay, I think from the session that many of us attended this morning and yesterday, we learned that the biggest potential impact is just telling a story of an individual instead of organizational history. Concentrate on an individual story. But from there, you have to then lead to what can be done about that. So a call to action. And I think the other main areas in which we're highlighting is that you have to know the story before you tell it. So everyone has to know that this is the central story of your organization, but you also have to be able to know your audience and know how you might have to spin it to bring certain people on board, because you have to humanize it and attract them to personally become involved. And I guess just to mention another one is just telling kind of, sorry. Okay, so you want to show the impact and the results of your organization. How then, if you tell the story and you do a call to action, what is their assistance and support going to actually produce? Is it a real result?
Fantastic. Let's think about the people communicating. So in your organization, the originator, the credible, you know, there was a credibility tag there. What sort of people do you need to do this in an organization?
I think you
maybe.
Well, I mean, we all have very many opinions, but I mean, I guess if I had to say something, I would say that you need people that are local people that can actually, you know, tell the story from the community side. So it's harder to tell a story from, you know, this international organization, that's trying to go in and be the saviors, but rather to take people that are actually impacted and that are part of that community and have them tell the story.
Have you reflected at all, this also goes to the others, how do you, as an organization with a clearer sense of vision within crisis, there was something about a crisp sense of solid vision that, you know, in the crisis, you need to narrow it down to exact evidence-based, you said, vision. How do you get people in your organization to share that? You know, you speak about local stories and pushing the message out in a way, but maybe what's the integrative part of the mission, of the vision?
Know your story. Okay. For me, that's the know your story before you tell it. So I think the vision is sort of before all of this, right? You've got to know, what's the big picture? Why are we doing this? And then you can relate it through a human, human impact story. But you've got to get the buy-in and internally and know what you're talking about before you can translate that into something that anybody else wants to hear.
Yeah, this is an interesting observation. You know, it's interesting how this somewhat, you could almost say, clashes with the spread the drivers out into your organization message. So if you say you need to have a unified vision first and then communicate it out through local stakeholders, where we had previously this idea that you need to that you need to decentralize in a way to diversify your teams. Sort of how does that work? Can we get insights from this table about, you know, this decentralized, more diversified organization? And is that at odds with what this table has been articulating about the central? Okay, then help us.
I don't think that we were actually saying develop your story and then filter it out through the people that you're working with. I think that would be inaccurate. The story comes up from the people that we are working with, and be unified in the way you tell that story and make it real and meaningful. Is there anything anybody else would like to clarify?
So, yeah. Yeah, so I think an important point that we were trying to share about telling our story was that the story should be told internally within the organization as well as externally outside the organization, so that everyone inside the organization is aligned in terms of the impact that you're trying to achieve. And the other point about results is looking at how is there a rigor in collecting evidence from the impact that you're having as an organization and even from external stakeholders to be able to show beyond the heart connection to the organization that you have with the story is there a solid evidence-based connection to show what you're doing, achieving as an organization?
Thank you. Yes, I think your wording was much clearer there. It's more about aligning than about centralizing. So thank you for that clarification. So in a communicatively aligned organization, where communication comes from the bottom up, how do you do what you've been trying to do? Can we get one more voice here in a moment? But maybe you could also start us off here with this group. So how does that relate to your observations here?
I mean, we were talking about how to communicate a vision. Often what I believe it's very powerful is that people are learning by doing, and it's not a question of talking and speaking. So when you hire new people or volunteers, for me it's really important that you give an opportunity for everyone within the organization to really know your core business and to go on the field and do the business. So they will be much more genuine afterwards telling the story, whatever the story is, and also become members of the family, if you
will. That's a very interesting addition. You say you have to know your business. So in a way, you have to know the core processes.
Exactly. Whatever you're doing. Yeah. I mean, you can be an assistant, an accountant, but at the end of the day, I see everyone within the organization has to spend some time doing and understanding the core business. Otherwise, it becomes too intellectual. And
this is quite an organizational challenge we're getting towards.
It's part of the training.
How do you let everybody participate in the few core processes that align an organization around its vision? It was pretty much your topic here, right? Do you want to share? I'm slightly confused. So you are group. But you have insights on this. if you dealt with sort of diversification and the energy in the edges of the organization. So maybe you want to go and share what you've come up with, your insights.
Yeah, we talked a lot about founders, how founders step back. So one view was the founder should focus on the value and the vision and let the team focus on running the organization in line with that value and vision. But then we talked about how the founder can be a disruptive force because the founder's always coming up with a new idea about how it could be done better. And there are different views about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing or, you know, everything in moderation. We talked about how you bring new staff on board, you know, the sort of transition from charisma to bureaucracy. And so the ideas for this were, as we've heard, time spent in all parts of the organization, invest in your employees to go around the organization, and then you'll get a better outcome. Very clear statement of what is the vision that everyone can understand, but that needs to be refreshed with a whole team effort, not just one person. Mm-hmm. And very clear statement about accountability. These things help new people to become part of the founding team. People you hire have to buy into the values. That was one view. So the values are you have to work harder and get less. But then there was another view, which is actually some people just want the paychecks, and you have to accept that when you get to a certain size, you will have people like that. And that's a different challenge. Then we sort of talked about how does the founder actually transfer some of their power, not just to one person, but to a team. When you go into different countries, how do you find those people that you can transfer some of your founder power to? You need to find entrepreneurs. When people stop asking you for help, then you know that you've got someone who you can really depend on. And then we talked about the fact that not-for-profits don't have the same very clear boundary between the organization and the outside world. So in my organization, we say Peace Direct is like a school of dolphins. It's not like a whale with a clear, you are Peace Direct, you aren't Peace Direct. But actually, the people we fund, the people who fund us, our volunteers, we're all in this school of dolphins. And you need to recognize, therefore, that some parts of your team may actually be outside the organization. I think that's what you were saying, wasn't it? Have I left out anything, team?
That's very, very clear and succinct. Wonderful presentation and the perfect segue to the collaboration piece here, too. I've just...
Question.
Yeah.
question?
You had this point about that it's important for the founder to transfer power to the rest of the team. Did you talk at all about how that can happen?
Well, we have, I think we have
I'm aware of time, so
put your hands up and he can talk to you.
All right. Can we have that discussion afterwards? I'm just very aware of time because we need to get through, you know, we want to hear your voice too. So taking the segue, collaboration. How do you make collaboration happen inside out networks around the organization? What's special? What would you advise an organization to do to increase its impact in times of crisis through collaboration?
We came up with 4 points for collaboration. The first is you must know when to say yes and when to say no. Collaboration is an opportunity, obviously, to increase our organizational capacity. And many of us couldn't do things, you know, without collaborating with other organizations. But collaboration also changes the way that organization function. And there is limited resources. I mean, collaboration requires resources itself. So we must be quite clear as to whether we want to collaborate in a situation or not and be willing to say no when actually it doesn't make sense, because you don't collaborate for collaboration's sake. The second point is that the focus on collaboration should probably be on the mutuality of interest. No two organizations will have exactly the same interest, so it's easier to focus on the area in which there is interest and for which, you know, you respect each other, what each other is doing, but you focus on the area of interest. The third point is that the best way to collaborate is when there's clarity of what it is that we are collaborating on and clarity of the roles and what each party is coming to the table with. And then finally, you can take collaboration to a higher level when you focus on the other organization in terms of helping them to mobilize them in ways in which they might not otherwise be mobilized, by helping them to do things, creating platforms by which they can participate, right, and they can bring value to the table.
Wonderful. So the platform idea. Let's hear from the last group on teams and leadership. What would you advise an organization to do to increase its impact in times of crisis through leadership and teams? Very succinct. Go. Who wants?
So we talked about three things. We talked about leadership, and we talked about teams, and we talked about communication tools to disseminate and control information flows. Specifically for leadership and teams, we talked about how during a crisis, the trust is shaken. Sorry?
I'm trying to write
notes. Are you going to write notes? Okay.
Capture this
for
everybody.
When the trust is shaken and employees are doubting whether they have enough sources or will they get their salaries or will they even be a mission drift. And there were several good solutions that came up. One of it was to break big goals into smaller, reachable targets and create quick wins so that people are still motivated to go through the crisis. The second one is to understand individual motivations, but also as a leader, how you bring in a commonality across the organization, a shared vision. And there's a story from Walmart on how they use a binary tool where each time an employee has to do an action or to make a decision, they have to ask themselves a question: does this support the mission of the organization, yes or no? If it's yes, do it. If it's no, probably not. Very clear, succinct way to monitor motivation and interest alignment. And then there's also an input on how we should frequently send everyone in the organization, including technical and admin staff, to the ground, to the field, to reconnect with beneficiaries, to really see what work the organization is doing, such that they witness the importance or significance of their contribution to the organization.
Okay, we've heard that before. Involve everyone in the core tasks that are close to the
ground. But also to see and feel and to sense what's going on in the field.
Wonderful. Any additions?
In terms of communication tools, various inputs ranging from having 2,500 Ashoka fellows to speak different foreign languages. And when you operate in a very multicultural setting, that will be important. that personal touch and that local language thing. And yeah. They have country offices, and there's a good example of how meetings can be used more efficiently to drill down to the core issues rather than to exchange information. So they use instead blocks to exchange information prior to the meeting, so that during the meeting you don't waste time just sharing stuff, but you can discuss and solve problems.
Okay.
A frequent occurrence of weekly team meetings.
We're far beyond the list of 2-3 major okay. insights here. So if no CEO can remember all of that. You know. let's bring this home this session and sort of try to build on all your fantastic insights, and we'll transcribe all of them and put them on Pathable. If you have notes, give them to us before the end of the session that we can transcribe them. Okay. Diana, you've mentioned at the beginning that we have learned quite a bit over the past few years. Which of the insights that were generated in this room ring particularly familiar to you with our practices at Ashoka and how we have changed our organization over the last 2 years? Let's just have a final short conversation, and then we'll let you go to have lunch.
Change and continuity, I think, are so not, you know, this builds on a long, many years of history and much continuity. The shared vision piece as a magnet to that builds community and builds trust is something that is critical and key, has been a core part of our experience, and the shared vision that incorporates the many that are part of a movement, not simply a shared vision among staff, but other stakeholders and beneficiaries. There's resonance around this idea of sometimes individuals are leaders and sometimes they're followers, and there are different moments in an organization and institution where that differential happens. And so what's the mechanism that we have or that we can build in so that that is fluid and that we continue to learn from that? And Ashoka is working on a notion of team of teams, that there you have to build a team of teams to be able to, that helps with this fluid movement between sometimes leader, sometimes follower. You're on one team and you're the leader, the next team, you're the follower.
So and I could be your boss in a project.
Absolutely. You were today,
which,
right?
Which, in fact, happens.
Yeah. What else? So pulling out another thread that I hear that resonates with pieces that Ashoka's building is, how do you ensure succession? How do you ensure next generations of leadership? It's the entrepreneurial piece, building an institution where you're pulling in the next generation by building a team of entrepreneurs who are entrepreneuring. And that also helps the organization to stay less bureaucratic and become continue to be innovative and entrepreneurial. There's another side that many people ask me about with that is, what happens when you have all these entrepreneurs running around? Let me tell you what happens. I can tell you. I mean, so the management strategy or the how-to there for us, and I like to call it a how-to rather than a management strategy, is ensuring that you have a couple of some protocols. You're not building, you know, very thick manuals of policy, and you know, you have your policies and you have your manual policies, but for everyone in the organization to understand the business and for everyone in the organization to be part of the movement, you know, what are the 7 protocols that are the principles and values that everybody understands and can remember in their head every day that guides behavior and judgment? Our core values should be online. I think they are. Yeah, protocols.
They're so simple. I mean, we can share them, but as a country director, I would say I only really know three. You may crucify me, but I really only know three core protocols. It's probably more, but there is the venture process, how we elect and select new Ashoka fellows, and we let everybody participate in that. So everybody understands that. It's the DNA of the organization, and it's the same protocol that we use for staff. So that's one that is very simple to grasp, and it's unified all over the globe. Another is financial reporting and how we calculate stipends and stuff like that, so that we are globally integrated financially. And then how we engage people as a platform. We have the Ashoka Support Network as donors, and we have different ways that donors work with us that make sense across the globe, although they are locally very different. To me, and then we have a performance review process that helps us develop the entrepreneurial skills of people. That is almost it, I would say. Beyond that, I can, everybody can innovate.
Mm-hmm. There's also just the shared vision that, as a key principle of what everybody embodies, but we covered that already. There's a governance piece. We have multiple organizations, and so there are some protocols, around a shared governance model that even in its diverse offices we replicate globally. And, that's going to play out legally differently because there are different laws everywhere. But, again, there are a couple of protocols that are part of that organization. But well done, sir. I guess the last piece on the is around this notion of what I like to think of as spread, not scale, and that incorporates is part of the networking and the collaboration piece. That I like to use the terminology of spread because when your goal is social impact, you want your ideas to get traction, and you don't necessarily want to own them. And in business, you need to own them because your ownership is linked to your bottom line and your stakeholder value,
So my incentive for my piece of the organization wouldn't be to grow it in size, but to make sure that if we grow the impact, we spread the practices globally, but definitely not to grow the German team or the German bottom line or so. Would definitely not be an incentive, and it is not.
And you can collaborate and build and connect with other networks to spread that. I think.
Any succession plan?
Pardon?
Is there a succession plan?
Is there a succession plan for Ashoka? There is a succession plan for Ashoka. Yes, we're building the next generation of.
All right. Thank you very, very much, everybody. And don't forget to hand in your notes if you want to see them on Pathable.